Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Harvey Weinstein is just the latest high-powered executive to be publicly outed as a serial sexual harasser. Stories of systemic sexual discrimination and violence have played out in the tech industry of Silicon Valley over the past year at high-profile companies such as Amazon and Uber. Taking to social media this week, women across the country have shared their own struggles with the cryptic Me Too posts. For many, the abuse occurs in the workplace. The awareness is there. The conversations are ongoing. Today, we're talking about when awareness and conversations lead to change. Joining us is Hai Feldblum. She's commissioner on the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That's the federal agency charged with enforcing anti-discrimination law in American workplaces. Commissioner Feldblum, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I just want to let people know that we are going to talk specifically about the Me Too reference later on in the program. So, Commissioner Feldblum, how big of a problem is this? We only usually hear about it with reference to people like Harvey Weinstein or, big profile people.
Well, it's actually a huge problem in this country, and it is a problem across industries, across income levels. The EEOC, which receives charges of discrimination, including harassment, we get 90,000 charges a year, a full third of those charges. 30,000 charges a year are harassment charges, and the truth is most people never even file legal charges. The research shows that really about 15% of people who experience harassment in the workplace ever even come to us. So this is a huge problem.
Is it partly that people don't really understand what harassment is?
Well,
they know they don't feel good, but they don't know why.
Right. Well, no. I think people know that something is not right. They may not understand that it is illegal, but many, many people do know that it's wrong and illegal, and they do not come forward either to us with a charge or even internally to complain because they are afraid. They're afraid of retaliation. They're afraid of not being believed. And let me tell you, the research shows that they're right to be afraid.
How so? Yeah.
Well, because the surveys show that of people who did report, over half of them did experience some form of retaliation, either professionally or socially. So if you're in a workplace where the culture is such that harassment is tolerated, and you see that other people have complained, and either nothing has been done, it's been swept under the rug, or they've actually suffered harm, why would you come forward with your issue and your problem, even if you know it's illegal?
How does the EEOC then protect against this kind of harassment and discrimination?
So we do it in two ways. One, if someone does come to us, we do investigate. We do try to settle issues. We've gotten millions of dollars on behalf of people who have come to us. But like I said, that's tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. What we've been doing more recently is engaging in a proactive campaign to change workplace culture. Literally just a week and a half ago, we rolled out something called Respectful Workplaces Training. Okay, this is not your usual sexual harassment training. This is a very skills-based training on how to be respectful in the workplace on all bases. Because as one researcher told us, workplace incivility can often be a gateway drug to illegal harassment. So let's just nip it in the bud. Let's make it clear to people how you treat others respectfully in the workplace and give them the skills for doing that.
You know, when I was getting voice training one time, the mm-hmm. coach said, you know what, you're eventually going to have to change how you speak all the time, not just when you're on the air. Can you just isolate it to workplace and not extend it to the larger world in which we live?
Oh, that's such a fantastic thing to say and message for you to get from the coach. Of course, it's overall social culture that needs to be changed. It has to be overall that it is simply not okay for a man to harass a woman. Anything from you know, crude remarks to her to an actual, you know, sexual come on. However, we have to start in all those places. That's why all actors, social actors, are necessary here. Employers, employees, community groups, government, we all have a role to play in our own space. What EEOC is playing a role in is in the workplace. Number one, being there as the sheriff in town if we need to, but also reaching out to employers and employees to say, let's work together to change at least the workplace culture. And I will tell you one other huge and different piece of this training is what we call bystander engagement training. Because lots of people see harassment happening to others. They don't like it. They don't know what to do. They think, oh, it's not my problem. Or they think if I get involved, I'll end up getting harassed. So one important part of this training is to teach bystanders realistic options for getting involved, for intervening. Because there are different power dynamics in a workplace. Not everyone can intervene in the same way. But teach them the skills and have the employers say, we want you to be engaged.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about sexual harassment in the workplace. My guest is Hai Feldblum. She's commissioner on the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That's the federal agency charged with enforcing anti-discrimination law in American workplaces, including anti-harassment law. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How does the commission define systemic discrimination, and how does that relate to what happened, you know, what we know about with the Harvey Weinstein thing, with what was going on in Silicon Valley and that kind of thing?
Well, legally, sexual harassment, racial harassment, any of those kinds of harassment, all of which are prohibited under federal law, to be illegal, the harassment either has to be severe and take any of the allegations of sleep with me and then you can get ahead. That is a severe situation of harassment. That one incident would be illegal. If proved, the business would be liable. There's also other forms of unwelcome sexual behavior, right? Constant comments of, you look so sexy in that dress, or, oh, it would be great if you'd go out on a date with me. Things that on their own might not be severe, but they constantly happen. So the law says things that might seem small, but if they constantly happen, that is illegal harassment. So we go after both of those.
The obligation of the victim, is that a thing? Is there an obligation to say no, to say I don't like this legally?
Oh, no. I mean, if there's something that would not be clear to the person saying it, that it's unwelcome, obviously the person has to convey that it's unwelcome. Mm-hmm. I mean, legally, you have to show this was unwelcome. Mm-hmm. Lots of things will inherently be unwelcome. Other things, you know, you're asked out for a date, that might not be unwelcome at all. But if you say, no, I don't want to go out for a date, and then the next time you're asked, you say, it makes me uncomfortable that you ask me, that's all you need to do as the person. But the other legal requirement is a manager, a supervisor, if that person is told by the party who is experiencing the unwelcome conduct or someone else who saw it and says, this is happening, a legal obligation kicks in for that supervisor. He or she has to do something. It's not an option. Legally, that person has to do something, has to take the complaint seriously, convey it to whoever in the company is supposed to deal with it. They cannot sweep it under the rug. If they do, they will expose their employer to liability.
What kind of advice do you give to people who think that this is a problem and they're not sure what to do about it? Sometimes people say, well, you should keep a diary, you should write it down, you should tell other people. Because it's sometimes, I mean, people think, well, who's going to believe me over my boss or over someone else? It's someone's word against the others.
Right. So there's two things. This is why creating a culture in which everyone feels responsible for making sure harassment doesn't happen, this is the engaged bystander culture.
Mm-hmm.
If you know you are in that type of culture, it will be so easy for you to be able to turn to other people and say, this is what's going on. Help me think through how to deal with it. Because then other people feel, oh, yes, this is also my responsibility. And, in fact, the employer will be happy that I'm helping someone come forward with this. That's the piece. I mean, otherwise, you, of course, keep whatever records you can. But so many people end up just leaving their job instead of complaining. I mean, one of the most troubling statistics I learned was that about 70% of people never even complain internally to anyone. They talk to their friends and family, and then they suffer in silence. And if they can leave economically, they leave. And that's really bad for their career.
Deb in Columbus, you're on the air with Hi Feldblum of the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I spoke to your screener. I was telling him that back in the late 80s, I worked for a community-based organization here in Columbus. And I was just kind of getting started my career, maybe 5 years in. And I had a moderate level of credentials, so I had a potential ahead of me. And my supervisor, who I'll call Mr. X, had a tendency to want to rub his hand and arm, all up my arm and shoulders. And I was uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
And I kind of moved away, and I said, you know, please don't do that. But he kept doing it. And so in the course of my job, I ran across a local attorney who was kind of friendly towards me. And I said, pragmatically, what can I do? And I asked a question because there had been a case in me, national news at the time, or at least major local news at the time, a woman who had a man expose himself to her and do crude things. So that was pretty evident.
So what did the lawyer say?
Okay, he said, pragmatically, you can do things, make a report, and hope that it builds. You can build a case over time. Meanwhile, you ruin yourself pragmatically, or you can leave. I've only been here 10 months and start all over again. And so I left. But I had no really crude or extreme behavior I could point to that would show. And plus, I was trying to build a career.
Yeah.
And what happened in his case, real briefly, was that he had a family situation that was severe health-wise. So he left for a while. So, oh, good, I got a break. But then he came back.
And it was the same.
And he left alone.
Let's hear from Hi Feldblum. Is that a and Deb, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it. Familiar story, Hi Feldblum?
That story is way too familiar, way too familiar. And one of the reasons that women are sometimes harmed in their career development is because they leave, either because they're told by someone, look, you really don't have enough of a case, or they just don't want to try to go forward. So let's take this example. If a supervisor puts your hand on your breast, right, that one incident is absolutely enough to be considered illegal harassment. If the person just first rubs your shoulder and neck in a way that makes you uncomfortable, that's still physical contact. And if you tell that person that is not welcome, and the person does it even one or two more times, from our perspective, that now becomes illegal harassment. It's always good initially, if you can, to tell the person simply to stop. Right, for that, the people who don't know that this isn't the thing to do. But as soon as it happens just a few times more, do not wait another 2 to 3 weeks. Really, go to anyone in the company. If they have an HR department, you can go there. But you can go to any other supervisor. And if you tell them this set of facts, this happened once, I asked the person to stop, it's happened two more times, this is the key thing. That supervisor now has a legal responsibility to do something. Now, that might not be enough to create liability, you know, for the company, but Deb didn't want liability. She wanted the activity to stop. That's what most people want. And if you go early to anybody who is a supervisor, you at least have a chance, maybe even now that there's more focus on this, you have more of a chance that it will stop.
Before I let you go, when we see these high-profile scandals erupt, is there more reporting at the EEOC? Do you see some kind of, you know, some reaction out there?
Well, we do try to obviously track the trends, but there is obviously a time delay.
Yeah.
I would say the most unfortunate thing is that the numbers have just stayed the same. I mean, it sometimes goes up, but I think people continue to be afraid even with a high-profile situation, but I do believe that each one of these incidents helps shine the spotlight more on the problem, and the only way we will change workplace culture is to shine the spotlight and then have a targeted strategic effort to change workplace culture.
Hi, Feldblum. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me on.
Hi, Feldblum is a commissioner on the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the federal agency charged with enforcing anti-discrimination law in American workplaces. Coming up, we're going to talk more about all the psychology about this, the trauma, why it matters, when it's happening, how you know. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you want to join the conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Sexual harassment and assault scandals have erupted, of course, recently in Hollywood and Silicon Valley. Today, we're talking about the prevalence of this illegal conduct in the workplace. Recent public revelations identifying Harvey Weinstein as a serial harasser and alleged assaulter may seem a world apart from everyday Americans, but the Me Too social campaign that has flooded Twitter and Facebook suggests that sexual harassment is extremely common. Joining us now by phone is psychologist, human resources consultant, and assistant dean at the Excelsior. Program director for human resources and leadership at Excelsior College in Albany, New York, Dr. Michelle Paludi. Dr. Paludi has written extensively on the topics of workplace discrimination, diversity and inclusivity, and sexual harassment. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Also with us by phone is Associate Professor of Management and Information Systems at Kent State University, Deborah Knapp. She researches workplace sexual harassment and provides sexual harassment training to public and private organizations. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Debbie, what is sexual harassment training? What do we even mean by that these days?
Well, when I do sexual harassment training, it's about informing usually a workplace population about what sexual harassment is, what you should do about it, what your policy says, and what sexual harassment isn't.
When people are talking about this in these training sessions, where do you find the most gray areas? Where do the wires get crossed most often? What's most misunderstood?
One of the things that's misunderstood is people, and particularly men and women, have different perspectives on what sexual harassment is. And when you get into the gray areas, it usually has to do with coworkers and, you know, whether it's okay to tell an off-color joke. If I tell an off-color joke, is that sexual harassment? Usually that's where you get the gray areas.
Dr. Paludi, some people think it's just so obvious, and other people think, well, I don't get what it is. There seems to be a huge conflict of what matters and what doesn't out there. Are we all coming from different places?
Well, it's a very true statement that you made, Ann. I mean, many people, as Deborah mentioned, don't see the more subtle forms. They might not think it even rises to the level of sexual harassment, especially when it's a microaggression or microassault, and when speaking up about it, you're told, oh, you can't take a joke, or you're too thin-skinned, or I wasn't trying to do anything to harass you. And that silences people, and that probably will make them not speak up later on if they think that's how they're going to be treated when they're speaking about their experiences. So the other issue revolves around the fear of retaliation. So sometimes people might say they don't understand if a certain behavior rises to the level of sexual harassment because they fear being referred to as a whistleblower, or that they might have a negative performance review or might even be fired as a consequence.
Deborah Knapp, how are people trained, going to that point of when you actually do tell somebody and they say they don't believe you, or you might have dramatizing, you read the wrong thing into it. I mean, how do you suss out something like that?
Well, first of all, someone should never be told that they're not believed or they're being too sensitive, but it does happen. And a good human resource manager would investigate the claim. And usually what happens is if someone's being sexually harassed, the perpetrator, it's not their first time. The investigator will usually find other incidents of it. But as Dr. Paluti said, people fear retaliation. Most victims of sexual harassment do not report it.
Yeah, they don't report it because they're worried about losing their job or having their career sidelined, that kind of a thing. What's the difference between a training program created to avoid legal liability versus one that really wants to make a difference? Is there one, Debbie Knapp?
I'm not sure how I would describe that. I think that some of the online programs don't do a great job. I think it's important to be in a room with people so they can ask questions, because people get revelations when they're discussing things.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Paluti?
Absolutely. I agree with Dr. Knapp. And in fact, I don't see those two items being separate. Certainly we have to cover legal issues, behavioral examples in legal definition, for example, the impact of sexual harassment on individuals' career development, emotional and physical health, interpersonal relationships, and self-concept. But also we need to, in the training, tell them what the role and responsibilities are of being a complainant, a respondent, or a witness for either party. And we have done a great deal of research on the kind of training method that works best in terms of retention, in terms of decreasing the incidence of sexual harassment, and that's through the discussion of case studies. So I will start out with a case and then through the discussion, ask their opinions about the case, whether harassment occurred or not, and then through the discussion, talk about the legal issues, responsibilities for reporting, et cetera. One of the other things I wanted to mention is that when researchers have asked employees what would so-and-so do in this situation, and referring to a case study, they're very quick to say, report to HR, bring witnesses, make sure that you make it better for people who in the workplace. But if you use the same case, the same scenario, and say, what would you do if it happened to you, they impose self-silence. They don't come forward. They don't recommend reporting it. So I think that's a very important key, and I use element of what we find in training, and I use that in the training programs to then go into issues of confidentiality and retaliation.
A high-ranking Republican senator from Northwest Ohio resigned his seat yesterday abruptly. He apologized for inappropriate behavior he had with a state employee. He said that after he met this woman who worked in a nearby state office, he sometimes asked her for hugs and talked with her in a way that was not appropriate for a married man, father, and grandfather like myself. His resignation has been accepted. This is very recent. We don't know a lot about it except what he said. And I'm wondering how you talk about how stuff like that even gets started. At what point does it sort of morph into something that's inappropriate in the minds of the perpetrator or what, Dr. Paluti?
Well, I think that with the current media attention to Silicon Valley and Hollywood, people are questioning behavior and are concerned about their own careers. So several people like this former senator will take it upon themselves to resign in order to show recognition of the inappropriateness and to save their reputation as much as they can. I think also it goes along with your earlier question, Anne, about what people deem as sexual harassment and not. Many times people at the level of making a compliment or giving hugs or some other kind of touching on the arm might, I think, that it's innocuous, but the person on the receiving end starts to be concerned about where is it going next. And that's why many people don't say anything at those first stages, because they're not really sure if it is or isn't sexual harassment. They're afraid if they speak up about this, they'll be seen as highly reactive. So they keep quiet. And then what happens eventually is that the hugging, the touching on the arm gets, it grows into a other kinds of behavior, and at that point, the recipient understands that this is what was going on all along, now feels more confident to speak up.
Pat in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Pat.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say that my daughter, who shall be remain nameless, mm-hmm. went to New York many years ago and took some film courses at NYU, and had a brief career with Harvey Weinstein. And when she came home at Christmas, I said, and she is a tough girl, by the way, I said, are you still working for Harvey Weinstein? And she said, oh, no, he's a dirty old man. I didn't ask her for any details, but, and I don't know, you know, what he did or what she considers being a dirty old man, but I just know. And that has been her. She wasn't married at the time, and she has a son now that's ready for college. So you know how many years ago that has been going on with Harvey Weinstein. And, mm-hmm. Of course, at the time, maybe she didn't report it. Maybe it was just him appearing.
Well, Pat, let me ask you this. As a mother, what did you think she should have done in reaction to something?
Oh, I'm glad that she
quit.
I'm glad that she sought other job opportunities, frankly.
But you know, Debbie Knapp, that's and I'm not blaming your daughter, Pat, but that's part of kind of the problem of this dynamic, right?
Right. She never
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Debbie Knapp.
Well, one of the things about sexual harassment is it's very entwined with power. And most people in positions of power in organizations are male. And some of them feel an entitlement to this behavior. I mean, I'm sure you can see with the numerous complaints against Harvey Weinstein that he felt entitled to treat people this way. We also saw Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly. I would see them in the same vein. So this tying of sexual harassment to power is very important, and the more powerful the harasser, the more difficult it becomes to complain about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Lana in Worcester, you're on the air. And by the way, Pat, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. Lana?
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, I recently lost my position, and what happened was the supervisor, who was the all-power, all-knowing, et cetera, mm-hmm. falsified documents, made up lies, and used rumor to basically show that I was incompetent in my position.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering if, and I could not, and I even went to HR, and they sided with him, and which I don't understand because I had proof.
But what does that have to do with, were you being sexually harassed? Was he?
No, my question is that a form of any kind of gender discrimination or sexual harassment?
Debbie Knapp?
Well, it depends on the activities that occurred. If he regularly does this to females, you can consider that sex discrimination if it's a consistent behavior. I didn't hear anything sexual, so I wouldn't call it sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Dr. Paludi can weigh in on this.
I agree with you, Dr. Knapp. First, let me say that I'm sorry that you're going through this. I'm sorry that you have to deal with this. If you want to pursue it after you've exhausted the internal process at your organization, and anyone always has the option of filing a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or State Human Rights Division for them to determine whether or not there was some sex-based discrimination, as Dr. Knapp suggested, without further information, and I'm not asking you to share more, but it's really hard for us to provide any more information than that. You may want to seek out a labor attorney to help you, a labor lawyer to help you.
Lana, thank you so much for your call. Good luck with that. Our number is 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Me Too campaign, what that means. We're going to talk about what trauma, psychological trauma, is manifest from sexual harassment and sexual assault. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Sexual harassment and assault scandals erupting in Hollywood and Silicon Valley. We're talking about the prevalence of this conduct in the workplace. Still with us is psychologist and human resources consultant, Dr. Michelle Paludi. Dr. Paludi, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Also with us, Associate Professor of Management and Information Systems at Kent State University, Deborah Knapp. Debbie, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks a lot.
What, Dr. Paludi, what is the emotional and psychological trauma of sexual harassment? Let's set aside actual, you know, rape and physical assault and just talk about, you know, the employer who's rubbing his arm up against his employee's arm and that kind of a thing, the unwanted touching. When it goes on, is there trauma from that?
Yes, there can be, and that would include some symptoms with respect to emotional well-being. Very often individuals who are being harassed, including sexual harassment, report crying, report anxiety, sometimes depression. They may experience with more severe forms of sexual harassment, post-traumatic stress disorder. There are physical responses individuals experience, including headaches, gastrointestinal problems, sleeplessness, and in terms of career development, they might change their career altogether. They might fear retaliation and so leave their organization, or they also experience interpersonal relationships disruptions, fear of meeting new people. They also fear crime more crime in general. And then self-concept seems to plummet. They talk about themselves in a negative way. I should have seen this coming. I should have been more attuned to what they were doing to me. And, of course, we can't control that. We're not sure what's going to happen when we run into a certain person in the workplace. But all of those make sexual harassment a major form of sexual violence in the United States, along with rape and child sexual abuse and dating and domestic violence.
Debbie Knapp, what signals should employers or supervisors be getting on this kind of thing? Should they be, they're not omniscient, they may not know what's going on, but are there signals they can get from employees that they should be looking for that says something's not quite right here?
Well, one of the things is if they have a decent reporting system, documents should travel to a central location so you can identify someone who's being reported over and over again. Secondly, they should do a check of the climate concerning sexual harassment. There's a nice measurement tool that shows the organization's tolerance for sexual harassment, and that impacts the frequency and severity and pervasiveness of sexual harassment in the workplace.
I wanted to turn our sights now to the Me Too campaign, a social media campaign. It was started by actress Alyssa Milano, asking people to just say Me Too, to cryptically, granted, share the fact that you had been sexually harassed or sexually assaulted at some point in your life. There's a lot to talk about there, but right now I want to focus on one aspect of that. A local business wanted to print up T-shirts with the message Me Too on them and donate the proceeds to a worthy and related organization. They got a lot of pushback on several levels, including the issue of triggering. And Zachary Traxler, the businessman who wanted to print those shirts, he's with us right now. Zachary, welcome to the show. Hi, Zachary. Hi, Zachary, are you there?
Yeah, sorry about that.
Okay. Tell us what you were thinking when you wanted to print those T-shirts up. We've got a terrible connection. We're going to have to call Zachary back and fix that connection. But in the meantime, let's talk about the Me Too campaign in general. Dr. Paludi, what do you make of it?
Well, this reminds me of what Tarana Burke started a number of years ago. She created the Me Too campaign, I think in 2007, I'm not sure. What she wanted to do using this phrase, and Alyssa Milano, I believe, has done this as well, is to really start a grassroots movement to reach sexual assault, sexual harassment survivors, and to show that, that people are not alone and that a movement for healing is happening and it's possible. So by asking people to share their stories of sexual harassment, it's really helping them to talk about it again. And we know from research that people who have come forth, filed complaints, and sought resolution fare better in the long time than those who don't. What this campaign can help with, in my opinion, is for to help survivors of sexual assault, sexual harassment, connect with others to talk about it. Many of them have left the organizations at which they experience sexual harassment. The statute for limitation has passed for filing complaints. This can be a form of healing. And I believe that that is a way, for people to connect and to share stories. It's really a conversation starter for people. And it's a very powerful statement to say, Me Too. And that might be the first time for some people that they have an opportunity to talk about the violence that they experienced.
Okay, let's try again with Zach Traxler. Hi, Zach.
Hi, can you hear me now? I'm sorry.
Oh my gosh,
that.
So much better.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling back. Yeah.
Thank you for having me, and thank you to all the guests and everybody else that's called in. I know this is a very sensitive subject, and so with the idea of our shirt campaign, I think it came a little heavy and too fast. And honestly, this actually wasn't a campaign run through my company at first because I understand the sensitivity of it, and the about four dozen individuals that I talked to before even releasing the shirt, which at very first they were, either assault victims physically or verbally, and they said it would be a great idea. But then obviously as it became more popular online and the conversation started and the comments started coming heavy online, we started to try and backtrack and take a different approach to it, because it's one thing to post maybe on social media the words Me Too, and I know that it's probably been a real struggle for a lot of individuals, male or female, that have made that post and triggering other people as well as people start to share their stories. But that wasn't our intention at all.
Mm-hmm.
Our intention was to, you know, we appreciate and understand the importance of social media and social platforms. But with a printing platform where we print, you know, apparel and 700,000 other products at Traxler Printing, it's another channel for it to become more physical, more tangible in real life. So imagine seeing that phrase or any phrase on a shirt or something online and then seeing it as you walk down the street, down High Street in Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously making more of an impact. And that's what we were trying to do. There was also a campaign about 10 years ago that a woman started the same Me Too campaign around this, and she wore shirts. And so I didn't want to use that as a scapegoat or try and steal the thunder of any old campaign that existed before. But the idea was just to kind of shed more light on it and then hopefully raise some money for another charity. Now what we've done is after talking to 100 plus more individuals in one afternoon, about an 8-hour period,
right.
We released two new shirts. One is Got Consent. And the other is I Believe You. And overwhelmingly, the I Believe You shirt is doing extremely well right now. We plan on donating all of the proceeds of the shirts to Bravo Network and SARNCO, another sexual response nonprofit here in Columbus, Ohio. And we're not trying to get publicity out of this. If you look at our company and the stuff that we've done in the past, we're a socially conscious for-profit that has raised hundreds of thousands of dollars in the last 5 years for local charities and nonprofits and individuals.
Let's talk about, I want to hear from Dr. Paludi first about the triggering agent that some people said a Me Too t-shirt would be. There are a lot of people who thought it was a great idea, and then a lot of other people who didn't think it was a good idea at all and became very angry about it, and the triggering was one of the things. Dr. Paludi, what is that, and is it a thing, and what do you make of it?
Well, as I mentioned, I think that Tarana Burke, when she used the phrase Me Too, she talked about her desire to have this be empowerment of victims through empathy. And that's really what it was supposed to be. I know it makes people uncomfortable. You don't know how to respond right away to somebody that is wearing a shirt that says Me Too. It conjures up questions of whether you can believe them or not, why did they wait so long? Why are they coming forth now? All of those things that in many cases are, you know, myths about why people wait so long to report. They mm-hmm. wait so long to report because they fear retaliatory behavior, or they might not think their complaint will be held in confidence. So it makes people very uncomfortable. But the original, the focus was to be in support of victims of sexual violence. And this is the first time in many years that I personally have seen this kind of national campaign. This was lacking in 1991, when Anita Hill came forth to the Senate Judiciary Confirmation.
We didn't have social media then.
That's right. But there was very few people who believed her, or why did she wait to come forth, or mm-hmm. any of those things. We don't see that as much now. And I think that this kind of campaign will be very helpful in making people come forward, or at least connecting with other survivors who may be the first time that they've had that opportunity to do so.
You know,
it does make people uncomfortable. I have to admit that.
Debbie Knapp, you know, it made me think about something in the workplace that happens a lot. We see the flyers and the posters and that kind of thing for, are you being sexually harassed? Are you being abused? Those kind of things are always in the women's bathroom. And mm-hmm. every once in a while, I see them out where everybody can see them at the same time. Are we saying that somehow if it's in the bathroom where only women can go, that it's kind of part of the problem?
It may be, because about 15% of men are sexually harassed
right.
during their working lives. It's not exclusively women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it places an extra burden on someone to be silent because it's not in the open area and the whole organization can't see it, just the women that use the restroom.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, but I think the campaign itself is a way to say we will no longer be silent. It reminds right. me of the Take Back the Night campaign on college mm-hmm. campuses a short time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it may also put perpetrators on notice that, you know, we're not going to be quiet about this anymore.
Zach,
we're going to believe people.
Zach Traxler, what's the upshot for you personally? What did you learn from all of this? I know there was just so much going on yesterday on Facebook with this.
Yeah, I think, all of the campaigns that we've done in the past around apparel and raising awareness and money for causes haven't touched as sensitive
matters. Hey, Zach, could you put the phone in front of your mouth?
Yeah, I'm right here. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I was just saying, I think campaigns in the past that we've run haven't touched as such sensitive matters as this.
Mm-hmm.
And with everything being viral and spur of the second, not even the moment, that it's important that if we are launching a campaign that we do it quickly, but we also kind of do our research and cover our bases. And so I think that, on something such sensitive matter of this is that maybe in the future we will take an extra day, not even an extra hour, but an extra day to kind of weigh the community and the input that we should, and kind of reach out to our already existing network of all of the other charities we've supported and get their input. But, I just want to say that our company, has a core set of fundamental values, which are honesty, integrity, equity in our community, and quality in what we produce. And we stand by those values. And we are, I personally, and if this was affected by my company, are apologizing to anybody that was triggered by, the release of this shirt. So that's why we kind of step back and use these two other phrases that have gotten overwhelming support again, got consent and I believe you. And I especially like the I believe you one is because, I do believe all those individuals that are going out and saying me too. I mean, people like my mother and family members that I never knew were victims or never spoke up about it even in the home. So, and I'm not going to dive into any of their stories, but I think it's important that some way, because I own a printing company and I try to donate as much of my time and money to charity as possible, because I'm not in this to get rich. I'm in it to do just what Ben Franklin did with the printing press is, be socially active. I think it's a good place to start. And so, we learned a lot, and we're just going to step back in the future and give ourselves a little bit of extra time to consider a campaign before it goes live.
Zach Traxler, thanks for calling. I appreciate your time today.
Yep. Thank you for everything you guys do.
Take care. You bet. Haley in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Haley.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, I'm kind of behind because my original comment was about something that your guest from Kent State had said before, but I also want to comment on something that was said recently.
Okay, but we're running out of time. So.
Yeah, I know. For one thing, some of those posters are in restrooms so that especially women don't feel that they have to be out in front of everybody when they take a little tab off of it to feel, so they can call someone.
Sure.
I do know this from a family member who works in a public service office. One of my other reactions was I love the Me Too campaign because it gives people a collective voice to say this is not okay, because the sense of entitlement that perpetrators feel, that this is the comment that I originally reacted to.
Mm-hmm.
When people like Bill O'Reilly and Harvey Weinstein feel a sense of entitlement and we want to collectively say, no, this is not okay, it's an uphill battle, and we need more of these loud, open voices saying this is not okay, especially when, we seem to be shying away from noting that our very president seems to feel this sense of entitlement and that he is defending this very harassing behavior that he has perpetrated in the past,
Haley,
acting like it's all right.
Haley, we're running out of time, so I want to see what our guests have to say about that. Thank you for the call, Debbie Knapp. We're just about out of time, but thoughts about what Haley's saying? I mean, we've got these icons.
Yeah, and like I said, gender and power and sexual harassment are intertwined, and probably a majority of sexual harassment has to do with that power issue. I see it when I've been an expert witness. I see it in training. I see it in people come to me with reports and want to know what they can do. I have students come to me. I had one woman that worked for a police organization and said, I'm the only woman. They're treating me terrible. What can I do?
Mm-hmm. Deborah Knapp, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Deborah Knapp is an associate professor of management and information systems at Kent State University. Dr. Michelle Paludi, thanks to you as well. I really appreciate your insights today.
Thank you. Thank you for having this program.
Dr. Michelle Paludi is a psychologist, human resources consultant, program director for human resources and leadership at Excelsior College in Albany, New York. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.